Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Daiichi Sankyo, we had the pleasure of speaking with Amy Cree, MD, medical oncologist at Alina Health, and Juan Juan, MD, PhD, an associate professor in the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics Research at City of Hope, to discuss the management of adverse effects associated with current treatments in breast cancer. In our exclusive interview, Cree and Juan discussed treatment-related adverse effects one should be aware of and prepared to manage, recommended management strategies for these treatment-related adverse effects, and important points to emphasize to patients before they begin treatment. Across hormone receptor positive, triple negative breast cancer, and HER2 positive breast cancer, what are some of the treatment-related adverse effects that one should be aware of and prepared to manage?
So when we talk about our endocrine therapies, we're usually talking about side effects caused by ovarian suppression, aromatase inhibitors, and tamoxifen. So a lot of those side effects are going to be side effects which we already think about women having in menopause. So we manage a lot of hot flashes, and we have very effective medications for treating hot flashes. So that's something that patients should definitely bring up with their provider. Another thing we commonly manage with endocrine therapy is vaginal dryness. So that's very important that patients feel like they can have conversations with their provider about that. So when we talk more about chemotherapy, obviously those are a different set of side effects, often more fatigue, GI, nausea. And then when we talk about targeted therapies, in particular Herceptin or a lot of the other targeted therapies we use now, those all have their own unique side effects. So the doctors will talk about monitoring heart function, managing diarrhea for some of those medications. So each different treatment for each different patient is really going to have a different set of toxicities that should be discussed with the patient before they start.
With recent years, now we have novel antibody drug conjugates, we have immunotherapy. So that brought in some new scope of side effects, toxicity we should be aware. And for example, we have the PIK3CA-alpha inhibitors, which does have a tremendous amount of effort. Need to be there for the team, for the patient to monitor, and collaboration between endocrinologists and us to monitor hyperglycemia, dermatologists, and also immune checkpoint inhibitor has a series of potential toxicity. So I think it's really rather broad. And then most recently, I think we're all fully aware of one of the drug antibody conjugates targets HER2 may potentially associate with ILD. And we're living in the middle of the pandemic, so the clinical picture can be really perplexing. So I think lots of attention need to be paid for those as well.
I think what patients should ask their oncologist before they start therapy is, what are the common things we sort of expect? So there's certainly going to be a list of side effects that I tell patients, you know, these are the common things. You may or may not get them, but if you got them, that would be a pretty common side effect. And then also ask your provider, what are sort of the, you know, rare but serious side effects? And so those are sort of two different lists. And patients should just be aware, not every patient gets every side effect. So don't worry if you get on the internet and there's a long list of people who have side effects, because certainly there are patients who don't have side effects or very minimal side effects. But just be aware of what they might be so that if you experience them, you can talk to your oncologist.
And as Dr. Wani mentioned, you know, we have some of these newer agents, immunotherapy, antibody drug conjugates. In particular, I'm thinking of agents like trastuzumab deruxtecan and even margituximab. So with that said, what sort of broad in scope of toxicities are we looking at with these agents?
These agents, again, it's a HER2 target therapy. From the clinical trial data, the cardiac toxicity actually is not a huge concern, but I think the new toxicity, such as, you know, less than 10%, although infiltrative lung disease or ILDs for the deruxtecan drug conjugates. So it should be aware. And I think since the FDA approval, we're starting using these agents in our practice. We do observe a lot of grade ones incidentally picked up by scans, and patient didn't have a lot of symptoms. For the other drug, margituximab, I have not used a lot, honestly. It will be very similar to other HER2 target therapy.
So with that said, you know, in terms of the ILD in particular, are there recommended management strategies already in place for managing, you know, these anticipated effects?
And that's a great question. I think our lack of guidance is a major problem here. We don't know, shall we do regular X-ray? We know X-ray has a limitation. For example, it doesn't really pick up a small amount of, you know, fine details that you would see from a CT scan of the chest. But, you know, it is very loose how often the patient should be seen. You know, we normally scan them every 3 months, and patient need to be fully aware. A patient lives alone versus have a company, by family, have a great support system. It's very different. So sometimes patient could, you know, go undetected if they don't come back in time. So I think building a safety network and collaborating with our, you know, pulmonologists, you know, who are already overwhelmed by the pandemic, I think something, a guideline is being called upon.
And I think, you know, that was seen in phase two data. And so obviously there's a lot of phase three trials going on with that drug right now. So I think we're going, and there are groups I know, because I've been on the panels. So there are groups of medical oncologists and pulmonologists who are reviewing that phase three data and coming up with better guidelines to help guide physicians.
We have the trial data, but it's not always representative of what you see in practice. So with that said, how often do you find yourself dose reducing or holding treatment with some of these agents?
That's a great question. So if you look at the package insert for grade two ILD, the next action plan is to permanently discontinue the agent. So there's very small wiggle space for you to see them, treat them. And once they develop a symptomatic ILD with cough and found imaging, then literally patients should be permanently taken off. So I have a couple of cases in the past year, not a whole lot.
Yeah, I think it was like 9%, right, had discontinuation or something along those lines. So I think for breast cancer treatment as a whole, it also depends upon what your goal is. So this morning in clinic, I have a lot of patients who are getting their adjuvant or neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So for those patients, the goal is cure. So I'm probably less likely to want to discontinue early or dose reduce early, because my intent is to cure the patient, and I want to try to get all of their dose in on time. Certainly, do we ever dose reduce? Absolutely, but we're probably less likely to. If our goal is quality of life, not to cure the patient, but in a stage four setting where the goal is to help the patient live longer, but also better, and quality of life becomes very important, I think I'm more likely to make dose reductions or dose changes or dose delays early, because the quality of life of the patient is at the foreground for that scenario.
Absolutely. Well said.
And, you know, in looking at all the different sorts of toxicities that patients may experience, does it depend on the toxicity itself to say, this is a grade three toxicity across the board, we need to dose reduce, we need to dose hold?
Yeah, and I think we also look at what kind of toxicity is it? Is it peripheral neuropathy from a taxane, where this is something that may not be reversible? Or is it fatigue in the curative setting, where I may ask the patient, yes, I know you can't do much that first week, but it is resolving and that we only have to do this four times. So a lot of those decisions between the oncologist and the patient also have to do with, is this going to be a permanent or damaging toxicity, or is this just a toxicity in the short term?
And, you know, similarly, what sort of severity, if there is one, would require permanent discontinuation of a drug?
And those are also individual, probably with each drug. So I know we've kind of used the example of the pulmonary toxicity, but similarly with immunotherapy, there are some toxicities that based on the severity or the potential long-term effect of that toxicity, or even the potential for death, there are some toxicities where certainly, you know, immediate dose reduction or immediate discontinuation happens. And it's really individual depending on which treatment we're talking about. So for instance, Herceptin, you know, we monitor cardiac function closely, but we know with that drug that the majority of the patients who have a small decline in their heart function or ejection fraction are going to recover that. So for those patients in the curative setting, we're also watching that, you know, probably very closely, because we expect that patient to live a long, healthy life. And we don't want them to have permanent cardiac problems. Again, versus that patient who's maybe being treated in the metastatic setting, even if their ejection fraction were to fall slightly lower, we may keep going, realizing that the benefit of the drug at that point outweighs the potential for long-term risk. So it's very important for patients to have a good relationship with their oncologist and have these discussions. So although when we do research trials, the grading, the discontinuation, the dose reduction is very black and white when it's spelled out when I have a patient on clinical trial. When you're practicing sort of the real world medication, each individual drug situation, patient goal and patient experience weighs into these decisions.
And then also, it's a great point. And there are some interventional trials try to target this toxicity. For example, SWOG has a beta blocker trial, and some of the toxicity is actually reversible. So it really depends on the nature of the toxicity and patient's, you know, situation. I completely agree that for stage four patient, you know, there's probably a bit more wiggle space, but for early stage neoadjuvant patient, maintaining the dose intensity is so important for the long-term success. But for the immunotoxicity, it's a whole different discussion for especially young women who are going through, and we now see a combination of chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint inhibitor data come out, and maybe there will be FDA approval soon. So how to manage in that young population who may facing a lifelong immune toxicity that still remain challenging.
And as we know, those immune toxicities can escalate very quickly. Dr. Cree, earlier you mentioned how it's important to kind of discuss with your patient before they even begin treatment the toxicities they can expect. You know, with immunotherapy, what might that include? Because, you know, something as simple as a cough, which maybe to a patient doesn't seem concerning, but could very well be if the patient is on a checkpoint inhibitor.
Exactly. And I always say with immunotherapy, you know, those reactions are sort of rare. That goes more into the rare but serious sort of side of things. So definitely educating the patient, educating our clinic nurses, monitoring thyroid function, thinking about the adrenal glands, and if a patient is coming in with low blood pressure or extreme fatigue, if a patient's coming in with new onset headache, realizing that that patient might need an MRI. As you said, liver function test elevation, realizing early on that that could be inflammation of the liver caused by the chemotherapy. So again, most patients do incredibly well with immunotherapy, but you just have to have those sort of rare but serious things in the back of your mind. And they are certainly things we've seen in all of our patients and all of our practices. And I think at this point, the nurses and the staff are very aware of those and helping guide the patients.
Have your experiences with these sort of adverse events shaped how you sequence treatment at all? Is there any overlap there?
I think as breast oncologists and researchers, you know, these experiences certainly have us sort of think twice as we move this drug into the curative setting. And at this point, the FDA didn't give early accelerated approval for immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting. And I think it's to that point of there may be a benefit, we're seeing a benefit, but we're also seeing these rare but serious complications. And is that worth the maybe couple percentage points of cure? And I think we as breast cancer community really do think and weigh heavily when we're trying to make the best decisions for patients. So again, in the metastatic setting, if there's no other options or the outcome is that a patient isn't curable and we're trying to make them live as long as possible, these side effects aren't as relevant. But when we're talking about a 30-year-old who may be left with adrenal insufficiency, thyroid problems for the rest of their life, we really need to balance out the benefit of that drug versus the risks of that drug when we think about approving them in the curative setting. And so that's why the FDA probably decided to take a little more time and gather a little more data, particularly in the response to, is this actually going to improve the number of people we're curing? Is this going to improve survival? So they're waiting for a little of that data to mature.
And are there certain guidelines that you find particularly useful in guiding your management strategies?
I think ASCO has a guideline on immunotherapy toxicities. So I think the dosing of steroids, so on and so forth, is pretty clear.
And I think for nausea too, I mean, there's lots of good guidelines out there for chemotherapy-induced nausea vomiting. So we kind of look from our clinical trials to see how high the percentages of nausea were and then make recommendations for what the standard antiemetic package should be.
And are there preventative strategies that one can use to limit the potential or anticipated toxicities patients may experience?
we're now super familiar with growth factors preventing severe neutropenia. So that's been used for years. And then talk about a neuropathy, a simple measure, but not well adopted, is to use a cooling devices, cooling mitten, cooling socks to reduce the neuropathy. That's also a very effective measure, but I'm not sure, Dr. Carey, do you guys have that, you know, used for every patient going to taxanes?
Yeah, we do actually in the adjuvant setting. I've sort of done it both with and without, and I figure it's one of those things that probably can't harm the patients. We do it. It's a lot of work for our infusion staff and our patients, but I do find it very effective with the nail changes and the neuropathy. So we do talk to patients about it, and we have patients, a lot of patients do it.
Yeah.
How about you?
We try to do it, but sometimes we said go to Amazon to purchase that, yeah. But then they forgot to bring it. And then there's one time patients say, "Oh, I thought I was going to use it at home." I was like, "No, you bring it in." I think education, it's such a really easy way to prevent potentially lots of, you know. But I don't think we have a solid data, right? A large study to really prove the efficacy. Such a simple thing to do.
Yeah. And then, you know, we're looking at now too, a lot of integrative therapies. So we have a pretty strong integrative medicine program that's helping patients. I have a palliative care program that's actually working with medical cannabis. So a lot of those therapies, I think just in terms of maintaining overall wellness, are also very helpful. We do a lot of acupuncture for fatigue and for nausea. And there are quite a few studies on that, even published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. So those are also things that patients can explore to try to minimize toxicities.
Well, I wanted to open the floor now to you both. If there's anything else that you'd like to add regarding the management of treatment-related adverse events before we close.
I think as we stated, you know, really kind of having a discussion with your oncology team, what are the things I can expect? And then what are the sort of rare but serious side effects? And what opportunities do I have to minimize those side effects? And different patients explore different options there and are comfortable with different options, but just having good communication and an understanding of what's being recommended and what the potential gains, risks, and benefits are.
Absolutely agree. And patients are, a lot of patients taking a great initiative. They have online forums, they chat among each other. And sometimes, you know, some rare side effects such as permanent alopecia, I used to not to talk about it, but I noticed that patient actually gets more education than me regarding these potential rare side effects. So I think education is such a key.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Daiichi Sankyo. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science Summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.